You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. This is episode 45. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today my guest is the Bitcoin Rabbi. He recently came out with a new book called Bitcoin Money, and it is a great kind of kids intro to Bitcoin book, and so we're going to talk about that and about some other things as well. Bitcoin Rabbi, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. I had seen, when I saw that you had a kid's book out, I got really excited because I think that's going to be a big thing in the future is getting the next generation to understand these things because, you know, for us, we're making that transition of like having to kind of deprogram the way that we think about money and onto this new thing. And I think for the next generation, it'll be easier just to teach them Bitcoin and things like this from the start.
Yeah, you know, I kind of wrote the book by accident, or got to writing it by accident. We can get there, of how I came to it and why I wrote it and who it's for and what I'm trying to do. It's somewhat of a long story. It kind of builds up to it. So I don't know if you wanted to start there or kind of work our way up to the book and, you know, how it got built and got put together.
We can do chronological order. So we can do chronological order. I guess if that's the better way to tell the story, maybe we'll start with kind of your background and, kind of what you were doing before Bitcoin and then how you got into this.
I went to public school growing up. I was not raised in a like religious rabbinical household, but afterwards, when I was in high school and graduated high school, I decided that I wanted to go to rabbinical school. So I studied, I moved to Israel, I spent 4 years there, and I actually became an ordained rabbi. And since then, I've been performing as I'm not a like pulpit rabbi, but I'm a teacher. So I've been teaching all different ages, middle school, high school, elementary, you know, each year it changes of which classes I'm doing. And so I've been pretty much focused on education for the past 8 years or so, or at least educating youth, besides for educating others. And then I just in my own kind of spare time, you get interested in politics. So if you look kind of past all the politics and yelling and noise, and you can see really there's economics behind it, really, you know, the economics and the monetary system behind the whole world. And it just didn't, you know, I didn't really make sense. So I kind of looked into the Austrian, libertarian side of economics, and that made sense to me. It really, you could say that it all goes back to the stories that my father would tell me when I was a kid about how cheap things used to be when he was a kid, and how his father would tell him how cheap things used to be when he was a kid. And so, you know, when you hear these things, you know, that you could go to a movie for 5 cents, back in my grandfather's day, and you know, now cost whatever $10 or something. You realize something's going on here. Like, why should it work that way? So I was interested in hard money, and then my brother is actually in the high tech field in Israel, in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and he works with startups and apps and things. And so he came across Bitcoin. About two or three years ago, And he, after, I guess in 2017, and didn't really mention it until the price started going up, and he said, hey, you got to check this out. And he was more interested in from the tech perspective, but I was more interested in it from the economics perspective. And so I just started learning as much as I could about Bitcoin and like listening to people, listening to podcasts, reading as much as I could. And it just caught my attention and like caught me by storm. You know, they say like you get caught in the rabbit hole. So ever since then, in like 2017, I've just been, you know, every day learning more and trying to figure out more. I'm not a technical person. I mean, my field of expertise is Jewish studies, Jewish law and education. And so that's when I realized I couldn't be, you know, it wasn't my role to be a technological coder, programmer, or developer, something for Bitcoin. I was like, I've got to figure out something else that I can do to put myself in this space. So I just kind of figured that I can, you know, I'm being a teacher, I talk to kids, I try to simplify things, I try to express things. Also, just being a rabbi, you know, I give adult classes as well. And I always try to condense things. You know, some people like to talk long and try to give lots of analogies and stretch things out. But I always feel like if you can shorten things and condense ideas as much as possible, especially in this day and age, and especially for children, then you're going to get the most bang for your buck by you know, really condensing it. So that's it. Started with first, I have a presentation that I've been giving to like college students and high school students called Bitcoin and Judaism, and there I kind of go through the history of money, the history of Bitcoin, how the ethics of money, and you know, I'm trying to explain to you know, normies that Bitcoin isn't something to be afraid of, and it's actually got a lot of potential. And that's where I kind of started getting all of my ideas of my, you know, arguments for Bitcoin. And then I wanted to take it a step further and put it into my kids' book.
Very cool. Yeah, I think teaching people is, I mean, no matter what the subject is, but when you put yourself in a position where you have to teach others, it forces you to learn the material better. I know that just from, in my church, working with kids, you know, in a similar capacity, you know, it forces you to learn the Bible and learn stories, better than you did, because you say, hey, I have to actually present this to someone. So yeah, this podcast has been the same thing. Sorry,
you have to be able to answer the questions. You have to be able to rebut, you know, the arguments. You have to know both sides of the argument, so that you can, you know, so that you can have a conversation, so that you're not just having a debate, but you're actually educating. And when somebody asks you something, you say, yes, I know, I'm aware of that, but here's the response. So you do have to become the most educated, which is, you know, can be difficult if you're not a technical person. But that's why I really, in my book, try to abstract away all of the technicality. So like, for example, the way that I explain Bitcoin, which I think that so many people that are not, so many people hear blockchain and they think that it's like some magical, incredible technology that like is going to be involved in everything, and it's going to be in your coffee maker and all of that. And it's, you know, in my book, it's just a guy holding a clipboard with a spreadsheet. And it's like, all right, everyone get your clipboard. Everyone gets a spreadsheet. You know, we're all going to keep track of these numbers together. And basically, I mean, if you take away the cryptography and the, you know, a lot of the mining and complexity of it, it basically just breaks down to a big spreadsheet. You know, that's what the Bitcoin ledger is. And so I don't think that the technology is really the most interesting part about it. I think that it's the economic ramifications of what, you know, that we haven't had sound. We've never had digital sound money, and we haven't had really sound money for whatever, 50 years or 100 years, depending on how you're counting.
Yeah. I had a chance to go through the book with my kids last night, and you did a great job of simplifying it, because I would have, like you said, like if you take out the complexities of the mining and the cryptography, and I would have tried to find a way to explain that. And you're right. Like it's not necessary to try and explain that part to kids or even like, you know, adults. Honestly, I think the first time you explain Bitcoin, I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah, I think there's a mistake that a lot of people do when they're explaining Bitcoin is try to really explain the technical details of how the blockchain works and think that that's going to be the convincing, you know, the convincing idea. I guess there are two, I think there are two extremes in how people market Bitcoin that I think are mistaken. One is to say that the great thing about Bitcoin is that it's this incredible technology, you know, the blockchain, not Bitcoin, like it's a blockchain and that's fantastic and that's going to revolutionize everything. And here's how all the technological thing. And then another thing that people, you know, on the other side are like, don't worry about the technology at all. It's just fast, cheap, you know, but et cetera, and not focusing on the fact that really, I think the main point, you know, the whole point of the technology is to make it decentralized. That's the entire purpose of it, is that it's decentralized so that it can't be gamed and it can't be inflated away. You know, that every other money that you can make more of it, you know, people will. And this, the invention of what I think the most important invention is that you can't just make more of it. Nobody can just make more of it. So that I think is the critical point that I try to get across to everybody that I explain Bitcoin to.
Very cool. What, like in the classes and things, what are the common questions or rebuttals that you get?
Well, I try to preemptively argue against the things like a lot of people are convinced that it's used for illegal activities, or that, you know, and there's, I think that the mainstream media has pushed that, and there may be that there was a time in Bitcoin's usage where that was a main use case, but it doesn't seem to be just based on volume. That's not what it's used for now. People aren't really using Bitcoin much in merchant cases and in black market cases. But I mean, some of it exists. But so that's one thing. And I kind of bring out articles that like the FBI actually, you know, has done a lot of investigation on it. So, I mean, that I say things that, you know, real cypherpunks won't like about Bitcoin, because I'm speaking to my audience of people that don't, I guess, aren't appreciating so much the privacy aspect and the privacy measures of Bitcoin. So, you know, to your audience, you have to focus on the things that that would interest them. So, you know, I talk about how it's you can actually use it to pay your taxes in some states, that it's, you know, that it has been used, actually Bitcoin by name has been mentioned in Supreme Court cases, and you know, has been basically deemed legal, not a security, and there are regulations around it. There are, you know, not so many people I talk to, but there's the argument against the ecological, you know, the energy use and the environmental effects of it. So, I mean, all of these things have all been discussed, of how, you know, Bitcoin actually finds the most economical uses of energy and finds the most renewable resources. So it's just about kind of collecting all this information. There's so much wonderful information provided, you know, just on Twitter, on the internet, of Bitcoiners that have been addressing all of these questions for years and years. And most of them have already been addressed before I even discovered Bitcoin. So it's just about kind of finding that information and sifting through and finding the good stuff and throwing out the junk.
Yeah. So is the response in these classes like, oh yeah, we really like this now? Or is it kind of like ambivalent, or does it vary?
So I think people are still, a lot of people in their minds think like, you know, this is probably could be the future. A lot of people still think, you know, why is it going to be Bitcoin? It's probably not going to be Bitcoin. It's probably going to be the next big thing after Bitcoin. And so that's what I try to address in my book specifically, because I have heard that from so many people. The, you know, why is it Bitcoin specifically? That's the big like subtitle of my book, is why Bitcoin. And so when I'm answering why Bitcoin, I'm answering why not fiat, and also why not something else? Why not another cryptocurrency, either one that exists now, one of the altcoins, or something that's never been invented? You know, that's the common, the most common thing from people that are that kind of believe that cryptocurrency or what digital currency is the future, but are uncertain about Bitcoin, is like, well, isn't Bitcoin going to be the MySpace and something better is going to come along? So in my book, this is the thing. This is an argument I think Bitcoiners need to really hone the best and explain to people. And it does take more than a minute. One, I think it's kind of easy to argue against most altcoins because most of them don't have like any benefit over Bitcoin at all, and have all negatives that they're either, you know, pre-mined, or they're centrally controlled, or, you know, something like, or they're insecure. So those I think are pretty easy, but you still have to kind of explain to people why an open source software and a network that can actually improve and can develop, like, you know, SegWit can be included, can grow, and as the network grows, that network effect will overpower anything else that comes and tries to beat it in the future, or at least, you know, most likely that's what I believe is the case. So that is really where I think the main arguments have to be made, because young people, if you look at the polls, majority by far overwhelming of young people believe that cryptocurrency, something like Bitcoin, is going to be the future of money. And it seems just obvious. Like, to old people, it's kind of hard to explain Bitcoin to them. I actually have a quote on the back of my book that says, that's from my father. It says, "I learned more from reading this book in one sitting than from you trying to explain Bitcoin to me for 2 years." So that was him. Yeah. And, like, it took a kid's book to get me the idea of Bitcoin, because it was just hard for him to get. And even now, he's into it. He picked up a little bag for himself, but it's not the same. Kids that are born, you know, after Bitcoin and knew Bitcoin their entire lives are just going to take it as a given. Like, it's such an obvious form of money compared to fiat, which just, you know, at its face value doesn't make sense. That the government should be in control of all the money in the whole world and decide who gets it, how much they get, when they can use it, and then print more for themselves at any time, you know, based on their whims. That just doesn't make sense at face value. I always say, you know, nobody would vote for that. Like, no one would have
right.
That if you would give them the choice. I mean, people use it by default because it's the most liquid and it's the most stable at this point, but, or at least in the United States. But nobody would, if you would say, like, all right, we're starting a new money, should we have one that's limited in supply and fairly distributed, and everybody has it for themselves, or should we get to be in control of all of it, etc. I don't think anybody would pick that. And so kids that are born into this option, I think they are going to choose Bitcoin. And then the main thing that I am concerned about is, and you know, interested in, is steering them specifically towards Bitcoin, which I think is the most fair and has the best potential. And I think it's better for the world. You know, I've been actually dealing with a lot of translations for my book. We've translated now into German and Spanish, and we've got a bunch more translations coming out. I've had incredible volunteers and helpers and editors, and all a bunch of people have been helping me work on the project, and seeing all these different languages should, it kind of brings out the point of of the friction that, you know, money is a kind of like a language. It's slightly different because you can have two different languages, but you can't really have two different monies. You either have one or you have the other. But just like with money, like if you're trying to do business from the United States to China or to Europe, there's this friction between the banks and between the different systems. It's similarly, you have friction when you are, when you're trying to speak different languages and translate and figure out all the different rules. So that's really been like pointed out to me recently, with the, doing all of these translations.
Very cool. And so, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here a little bit, but if somebody wanted to, help as part of that translation process, how would they do that?
Yeah. So I have the text, I have it like open and I've got all the different translations. I don't think that I have it posted anywhere, like the specific link. I mean, I've tweeted it a bunch of times. Basically, the easiest way is if anyone, you know, gets in touch with me, I'm on Twitter, pretty regularly, you know, 6 days a week. I'm not on Shabbos, on the Jewish Sabbath, Friday night to Saturday night. I'm off all electronics and everything. That's our day of rest. But the rest of the time, I'm pretty much can be found, can be reached on Twitter. And people have reached out to me, people have connected, and then it's just like a Google Drive link. So I could put that in my profile. But it's pretty easy to find me. I'm at the Bitcoin Rabbi pretty much everywhere, everywhere where I am. So mostly Twitter. So that is how, anyone who wants to find me there, they'll find the books, they'll find how to translate. My DMs are open. So that's how, you know, that's how I like talking to people. I've had the best experience talking to Bitcoiners because I feel like there's this, you know, nice camaraderie and, the toxic Bitcoiner trope, I think, is so overblown, and people kind of like to overemphasize the negative voices, the few and far in between, when there are so many positive and helpful and kind people in the space, and those are most of the ones that I deal with. So I've had like a lot of incredible relationships and conversations with Bitcoiners of all different stripes. And it's nice to see, the variety of different kinds of people and the different countries and all that. I've been selling my book. I sell it for Bitcoin and Lightning on my website, and the orders come in from all across the world, like tons. I'd have to look. It's probably maybe 30 different countries or so, where people have ordered my book. So I haven't spoken to every single person from all the different countries, but it's cool to know that, my voice, my writing is getting out there and having this influence. And that's why I'm also focusing on doing the translations. I'm hoping to, I think French is coming next, Italian is coming, Russian, I have some different Asian languages. I feel like this kind of information and this kind of education can work everywhere and can work across the world. I like to think that eventually, we'll have either my book or something like it taught in elementary schools, as the basics of economics.
Yeah, that'd be very cool. So maybe let's get into how did you get to the point of writing this book?
Yeah, so like I was saying, that I have this presentation, and it is a lot of it is based on, or a lot of my opinion of Bitcoin is based on Saif Eddin Amous's book, The Bitcoin Standard, as well as other, economics and Austrian economics and libertarian economic books that I've read. There's like the classics, but I mostly what I have read was just been like online and through forums and through YouTube videos. But a lot of it, I think, is so inherent. The information is just like obvious. Like, people don't have words to express it, but like what money is and why we use money. What makes money, like the, I'll just kind of go through it. It starts with a trade. So trade is bartering. So people on, or really even before that, rather, I'll take one step back. It starts with specialization or with capital. People have skills and they have capital and they have things that they want to, that they can do better than others. And so then they want to trade with each other. So it goes from, you know, specialization to trade, and then it goes through the coincidences of trade. So if you want to trade with somebody else, you have to have a lot of things match up together. You have to be in the same place. You have to want what the other person wants. You have to have similar amounts. So it only works, like, you know, it works when you're at the lunch table and you've got a bag of chips and they've got, they've got Doritos and you've got Lay's and you want to trade with each other. It's an easy, you know, that's a trade you can make. But most things in the world, it doesn't scale. So money is what allows for the scaling of trade. But then not everything can work as money. So the kids, they all try different things. You know, it discusses all the attributes of money, what makes good money and what makes bad money. So like they try, see if grass clippings make good money, do shiny rocks make good money, do bicycles make good money, and then they settle on gold coins. Gold coins are pretty good money. Gold has been served as money for thousands of years. It's even, if you go back to the Bible, you know, silver and gold was money. Like that was the definition of money. Actually, in the Hebrew, the word for money is the word silver. Silver and money is the same exact word in Hebrew. It's kesef. So that was like the very definition of money, was like the basic unit of money was silver coins. And then the more expensive was gold. Then it's like in the story, the kids are trying to carry gold coins around with them, and they quickly realize that it's very cumbersome to carry around gold with you. And there's actually one point that I forgot to put in the book, but was mentioned to me.
Can I guess it?
What's that? What do you think?
The security.
Security. Well, no, I actually do slight. There's one line somebody did mention about, like, I should have like a bully that like tries to take gold, but I only slightly reference it. And I say, if you had a hole in your pocket, that could cause a lot of problems. So that's like
right,
the security
right.
That's a hint to the security of keeping your gold coin secure. But I actually don't mention what is it called? That you can't split gold coins apart very easily. A smith can make gold coins and can make, the divisibility of it. It's very hard to denominate, you know, unless you're using one gold coin. Like, it's not so easy. So digital money is much better for that, because you can have the exact amounts that you want. You know, every UTXO is custom made to be the exact amount that you need it to be. So they go from gold coins, and they're kind of tricked into paper money, and then that paper money has hyperinflation, and the money is being swept on the streets, like in Venezuela. And I actually sent the illustrator. You know, there's a famous picture of money, or maybe multiple famous pictures of money being swept in the streets in the Weimar Republic. And so I use that imagery, and then the hero of the story arrives, and Satoshi, saves the day. And I do skip a lot of, like I've said, I like skip a lot of the technical details, and I kind of skip from introducing Bitcoin immediately to hyper-Bitcoinization. So pretty much Bitcoin immediately takes over the world. So that's where it hasn't quite, I kind of skip a few steps there of how it, the financialization and monetization. But again, it's just a, It's to explain to kids how it could come to this age. And then you get like the cover of the book. The girl is, you know, accepting Bitcoin for lemonade. I do address Lightning Network at the very end, the last page. You've got the two kids developing the Lightning Network. So that's also hinted to in the book.
Yeah, I love it. And I after listening to your interview on Citizen Bitcoin, I went through and I tried to figure out who all of the characters were.
Okay. Every single character is, some of them are based on real people and some of them are like representations of ideas. Sure. So, do you have any, are there any that you haven't figured out, or do you think we've got them all?
Let me see. I'm not 100% sure on the Freddie and Kenny. I mean, obviously okay. They're the,
that one I'll give you that one is a little bit more abstract. So there are three boys who are basically responsible for the fiat currency of printing money, and they are Benny, Freddie, and Kenny. And Kenny is kind of like the villain of the story. He's the one who comes up with the idea of printing money and convinces the other boys to go along with it. So Benny starts out good. He's the one who originally wants to just secure everybody's gold and give them certificates,
yeah,
gold. So Benny represents the banks, who, the idea of a bank in itself is not necessarily a bad thing, to have a really trusted third party who does full reserve banking and provide services and that's the banks. And then his older brother Freddie is the Federal Reserve. And then
that should have been obvious.
And then Penny. So now, do you have an idea who Kenny is? Kenny is the one that convinced the banks and the Federal Reserve to print money.
Is that Keynes?
That's Keynes. You got it.
Okay.
So those are the three bad guys in our story.
Gotcha. Yeah. I like it. So yeah, there's definitely some other ones that are fun to try and figure out. I was telling my kids, I said, you know, some of these are based on real people. And then when I was telling my son about Satoshi, he was like, no, that guy's not real. I was like, well,
well,
you know,
we sort of. Yeah, we're not 100% sure, you know, he could be an alien or a government agency or an AI or somebody else. We've got no clue. That's part of the fun. I'm trying to think of who else are the fun characters. What was great about it was that I actually got to speak to almost all of the characters that are in the book. And, you know, I showed them preview copies of the book and, you know, I got to talk to them. So it was also a great part. One of the best things about writing this book and putting it out is, you know, getting to do what we're doing right now, is that I've got to talk to a bunch of Bitcoiners and, you know, see all different aspects of the community and all different types, from, you know, podcasters to people working in technology or financial industries or trading or people making products, all different kinds of things. I've got to really get more in touch with the community. And I've been to, now in the past couple months, I went to a conference, I went to a meetup. You know, I live in upstate New York, so there's not much going on in the Bitcoin world up here, but I'm close enough to the city that I can, that there's a lot going on there. And I occasionally make it down to mingle with the fellow Bitcoiners.
Yeah, so I was recently talking to Matt Odell about this, about the importance of community, and we kind of have the quote unquote community on crypto Twitter, and there's obviously, we kind of referenced that there's both good and bad in that, and there's or maybe I should just say positive and negative in that, but I really think there is something to like meeting people in person, and maybe that's a little maybe not the best for your personal, you know, security or whatever, but there's something to meeting real people in real life and having that camaraderie and that ability to kind of encourage one another.
Yeah. I mean, that people are friendlier in real human flesh space than they are behind keyboards. And when you see, you know, people in real life, I definitely think that it makes you a friendlier person towards them and kind of appreciate them. I just like one example that I was listening to Luke Dash Jr.'s presentation. I met him at the Magical Crypto Conference, and like we chatted, we had a very nice time. And when I listened to him speak and give his presentation about block size, which I've heard him say over Twitter lots of times, I found listening to him and like just something about hearing his voice, hearing his sincerity and his, you know, that he's a real person that really believes this is what's much more powerful than just reading the ideas behind, you know, on Twitter and then seeing the comments and the arguments and the back and forth. Like that gave a very human aspect to it, which made me appreciate the conversation and appreciate his viewpoint a lot better. So that's just one example of a person that I talked to first just on Twitter and then I actually got to meet and listen to. But yeah, there are dozens of people that, you know, that I would come up to during the conference or during the meetup and be like, hey, you know, I recognize you, I know you, and then chat. And then, you know, you see that there are a lot of different people. And I think that Bitcoiners have a lot in, very often have a lot in common. Even if they're very, very different people, just the fact that to be involved in Bitcoin, particularly in Bitcoin, you kind of have somewhat belief systems about, you know, liberty and about, you know, about economics. And I think that that kind of, there is somewhat of a, and, you know, technology or whatever. There are a lot, there are just a lot of shared ideas that make it actually nice to personally interact with people.
Yeah, for sure. And it, I mean, this kind of goes back to maybe the religious thing again, but, you know, I know that in my church, we talk a lot about like, you know, we have this unity despite our diversity of individuals. Like we're not all the same. We're not robots, but we have these common core beliefs that unite us in what we're doing despite all of our differences. And so I think like in Bitcoin, there's similar, it's not the same, right? But it, there are similarities in that we have certain things that we say like, this is important to us. And despite the different cultures, the different maybe political beliefs to some extent that we have, this is what we value. And this is what we are, this is what we want to work on.
Yeah. I mean, that's a, people compare Bitcoin to a religion, and I don't really compare it to a religion in the, like ideological philosophical sense, because, you know, my religion is very different than my, than, you know, my interest in technology and economics or, you know, or any kind of hobby that I have. But you still, when you, in the same way that like when you go to your synagogue or your church and you know that the people there have a lot of similar beliefs to you, there is that, you know, there's things that you can just connect on automatically. Same in that similar vein, when you are talking to Bitcoiners, you know, that you can talk about, you know, the, all of the things that are, that, that make us, I mean, especially because Bitcoin is all about consensus, you know, it is that we have the shelling point that there's this, you know, anybody could make any other coin they want or do anything they want or use any other kind of money. But we've all agreed that there is this point of focus that is the consensus rules that we think are better money than everything else. And so there's that kind of lends itself to a like a shared idea. You know, what's the phrase everybody's saying, you know, money is a shared
illusion.
Shared illusion. That's been going around. So, you know, we all, when we're all in this shared illusion, you know, it's like we've all got the same VR headset on. So we're all, you know, we're all in this dream together.
Very cool. Very cool. Let me ask you, because you mentioned earlier that you that a lot of your training was specifically like in Jewish law and things like that. I've seen this in a couple of places, but I don't feel like I've seen it explained well. Can you explain the concept of, is it called usury?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, usury.
And just because this is a kind of an, or the parts of it that I, the limited understanding I have kind of intersects with where Bitcoin has a lot of financial things as well. And so just looking for maybe someone that can explain it better.
So usury in the Torah, in Jewish law, is that it kind of takes it as a given that that usury is a common business practice, that it's something that, you know, that you, when you lend to somebody else, you are risking your capital, and therefore you need to make sure that you are getting, you're a few things. One, you're risking your capital, you might never get it back, and you are forgoing the benefit of using your capital, which you would have had. So that is kind of taken as that would be the normal standard practice of doing business with people, because it actually, you know, encourages you to do business with other people. But the Torah actually tells the Jewish people in particular that when they're dealing with their brethren, you know, their fellows, that they should hold themselves to a higher standard and treat each other like family. And so, you know, you would do that if you're in a business transaction, but you wouldn't do that if you're lending, if your brother, you know, needs money to feed his family or something like that. So it actually gives this, it says you're allowed to do usury when you're doing business, you know, with strangers or quote, you know, foreigners or that. But when you're dealing with your own brethren, you should hold yourself to a higher standard. I believe Christianity kind of also took that or uses that standard. I'm not sure if there are different levels. If interest is never allowed in any case, or if it's allowed to fellow Christians or that, I don't know exactly how it expresses itself in Christian practice, but that's the idea. But there also are ways in Judaism that you can do not exactly lending, but you can do investment. And so there is a system that where you are, it looks and it seems like you're lending money, but you're actually investing. So, you know, if somebody wants to buy a house, you are not lending the money for that house. You are taking an investment in that house, and then the person is. So it's just a different way that that it's structured. It ends up having a very similar results, but that is a way that's been figured out to get some of the benefits of doing business when business does need investment, and there is not enough, you know, charitable brotherly loaning to make that happen. So that's kind of how Judaism does it. But I mean, it's not, none of that is inherent in Bitcoin, and none of it is really changed by Bitcoin, meaning Bitcoin is just a money like any other kind of money. So, you know, holding Bitcoin is not usury. Giving, you know, spending money, there's nothing inherent to it there. If you are doing a platform that is, you know, lending and interest and that kind of thing, but then there is those questions about, you know, can it be done? How is it done? Et cetera. And there actually are companies, Israeli companies, that are, you know, actively deal with rabbis and try to make sure that they structure their systems that it fits according to Jewish law.
Okay, cool. We talked about, well, I had notes on here, but we kind of already talked about that of languages for your book. What's been the response so far?
Oh, it's been incredible. I mean, there's nothing gives me more joy than people sending me pictures of their children reading my book, and, you know, or really parents and children reading it together. The messages I've gotten have been like overwhelmingly positive. I didn't think that the book was going to be as big and widespread as it is, but just I've I've loved that aspect of it. And people, what's been great is people buying not just like one copy for their family, but sometimes people will buy 10 or 30. I've got like a discounted 10 pack, a discounted 30 pack, and then they will just like give them out to their, you know, some people have told me I bought 30 books. I'm giving them out to my local libraries and, you know, and to anybody who will take it. So that's been the idea, because Bitcoiners love, you know, Bitcoin spreads and Bitcoiners love to spread Bitcoin. It's got this like self-fulfilling aspect to it. So I found that if there's somebody that's just really not interested in Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, or they're skeptical of it at any age, children aren't going to be skeptical of it, but really any adult that is skeptical, this book kind of like puts them off guard that like, fine, I'll read this. Like that's not, it doesn't seem like it's a, like a scammy, you know, whatever, over my head technological thing. So people have told me that they, you know, that they've given it to family members and people that I've given it to that did not know the very first thing about Bitcoin. For example, somebody telling me like, I've never seen a Bitcoin. So, you know, people that really just don't get it all can read this book and get something, you know, that's been the response that I've gotten from me giving out the book and from people telling me who've bought it. And that's been the real pleasure of it.
Yeah, that's very cool. As we're sitting here talking, I'm wishing that I had ordered more copies, because one, the idea to give it to your local library, that's very cool. I hadn't thought about that. And then the other thing is I tried to get my dad to read. I let him borrow my copy of the Bitcoin Standard for a while. Uh-huh. And, you know, he read some of it and he said, it's kind of fascinating, but it didn't hold his interest.
Yeah.
And so
is the word a tome? Is that a, it is?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a, I mean, I've read it probably almost three times cover to cover. I really enjoy the book and, but it's a scholarly book. I mean, it's written by a PhD professor. It's not something that is an intro to Bitcoin. I think it's something for somebody that's already really in the, somebody who wants, you know, who's saying, I want to learn about Bitcoin. What's the best book to explain it to me, you know, the economics of it? Then you give them the Bitcoin Standard. But for somebody you're trying to convince to be interested in the first place, I don't think that will, you're just not going, regardless of how great the book is, you're not going to get somebody to read a 250 page book just out of, you know, just out of goodwill. So that's where I think that this is like the gateway, this is the gateway drug into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Have you ever read, any books by Connor Boyack, the Tuttle Twins series?
You know, okay. So it's kind of funny, that when I first posted the very first day that I came up with the idea to write this book, I actually tweeted out to Saifedean. I said, you know, at Saifedean, have you seen any books that are like your book about Bitcoin, but for kids? And he said, no, I haven't, but it sounds like a great idea. In the comment, that was his comment. And then in other comments were, you should check out the Tuttle Twins. So I went and bought they have like, you know, the full library. I think it's 10 books or something. I bought all of that. My kids love it. So we've been, we've read through those over the past few months, the Tuttle Twin books. And they just barely mention Bitcoin, like in passing in one book, I believe.
Right.
They really don't, because I think their books are kind of based off of off of classic libertarian books, like Hayek and Mises and there's a Ron Paul book. And so I guess they don't have one off of the Bitcoin Standard, but you know, that's kind of what I was going for. I wrote my book before I got their books, before I saw their books, but I actually ordered their books before I wrote my book. By the time they arrived, I had already written my book.
Yeah. No, I think yours complements nicely. They have the one, like you said, there's the one that kind of mentions it in passing, Creature from Jekyll Island. And I think that one does a really good job of kind of explaining.
Yeah, hard money, sound money.
Yeah, yeah. And and how like the printing of money kind of trickles down and has a hurts people more as it gets farther in the process.
Yeah,
and then at the end, it's kind of like
Cantillon effect. The Cantillon effect.
Yes, thank you.
Is whoever gets the new money first has the least effect from the inflationary aspects of it, and it's the last person that gets it is usually the poorest people have the highest effects of inflation.
Exactly. So and then right, like you said, at the end it kind of briefly mentions Bitcoin, and I think it even says and other things like it,
right.
And so. Yeah, that's kind of the closest we had until your book. So I'm appreciative of your book that kind of goes even farther and is like, you know, this is why the copies don't turn out. This is why.
Yeah, you know, that chapter like really was kind of an add-on. I wasn't sure that I wanted to even write it. And then I kind of had the book finished, and then I went back and forth with myself and about whether or not I should include men. I mean, because I also had the same thing when I was doing my presentation. You know, I in one way wanted to just, I've changed my philosophy, I think, from not wanting to mention altcoins at all to now I think it's important to specifically mention them and debunk the idea. I think that's an important thing because if you spend all this time explaining to people why Bitcoin and why it is limited, and then they find out that you've been hiding from them 3,000 other cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin doesn't seem so limited anymore. So you actually have to explain why Bitcoin still is limited and why the other coins don't really serve the role that they claim to.
Yeah. And I thought you did a great job without having to go into the technical details of each one and why they're not good. And just, I mean, it's, and obviously you're going to have maybe people who like those other projects that say you oversimplify things, but
that's fine.
But it's fine. It's fine. It really is fine. Like if you're an adult,
unapologetic Bitcoin maximalist, I'm not sorry about it. That's what I believe. Listen, if I'm wrong, then fine. Like I've been wrong about things before, but that's what I genuinely believe is both the inevitable and the best thing to happen. As I was talking about, you know, with the friction of different monies, I think that having one money is going to be the ideal system for the world.
I agree. And I think that what I was going to say is you did a good job of just, like I said, some people might say it's an oversimplification. I think it's a good way of just saying, look, pretty much all of these, you have to trust somebody. And at that point, then it's just as bad, if not worse, than the paper money that we were on.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not running a full node, you're not really doing, you know, that's the running a full node is the whole point that this system works, that there's a decentralization of nodes. If not, then it's just the miners are in charge of it. So, and you know, how many miners are there and how many mining pools? And if the miners are the one that print the money, which they do, you know, how soon is it going to be before they print enough money for, you know, print more money for themselves the same way that the central banks do? So, you know, in all of these, I don't know people that are running Litecoin full nodes or Ethereum full nodes or Bcash full nodes. It's not the ethos of their projects. And I think they're missing the whole thing, the whole point.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Trying to think if there's anything else. I think that was kind of the majority of my questions. Or I guess I usually kind of ask this more towards the beginning, but what, and you kind of mentioned like the hard money thing, but what is the maybe the most important thing or the thing that you want to see most out of a shift to Bitcoin over fiat money?
I think that the effect, and Saifedean in the Bitcoin Standard talks about this, that the effect of easy money and of inflation has this has a more nefarious effect on psychology of people, not just that their money is weakened, but it actually encourages frivolous spending. So I would like to see the mindset. You know, I think that the hodler mindset is that it's not just about Bitcoin, but it's that saving is important, you know, saving, planning for the future, and being a more thoughtful, more thoughtful in your consumption. I think that is a like mindset that Bitcoin has right and Bitcoiners have right. But regardless of the fact that, you know, that we're dealing with Bitcoin, I think that that's just a proper mindset. And so that is something that I hope will become more prevalent and kind of a return to I don't want to like I idealize the past, but more of a simple, you know, a simple lifestyle, like that you don't need to spend all of your money on flashiness and, you know, the pop culture and just immediate gratification. I think that expresses itself in all ways of life now. And I think that it's just damaging, and it's damaging to young people. So I would like to see, as people become more and more used to sound money that appreciates just in your Bitcoin wallet, that people now will become more thoughtful and more, you know, if you're not going out and spending and wasting money, you're probably not going out and, causing damage to yourself physically and doing, you know, reckless things. Not every single case, but I think that will have a global positive effect on people. And that's why I tell people, you know, why I'm really interested in Bitcoin, that as one part of it. But just I think that the effect that Bitcoin is going to have on the world economy, on individuals, on poor people, is going to be a positive thing. And so that's why I'm interested in it. I mean, the amount of personal gain, I actually did like a poll out on my Twitter yesterday of like how much of your interest in Bitcoin is based on your personal gain, your skin in the game, like your personal investment versus just your interest in this project. And I really, for me personally, you know, if it was just about my, you know, personal gain, I would, you know, buy, you know, I would dollar cost average, let it sit in my hardware wallet and go about my life and never talk about it. You know, I don't go out there talking about my stock portfolio and go on podcasts and like, you know, talk about whatever. Like my interest in Bitcoin is because I think that I believe that it will be a force for good, and have this beneficial effect on the world as a whole and for individuals that are involved in it.
Yeah. And I think that this is why your book resonates with people and their kids, because why it's important to them and that they share it with their kids, because I think Bitcoiners are having that more long-term mindset and thinking about the next generation or generations.
Yeah, and I think that the book is optimistic, and I think that Bitcoiners are optimistic in a good way, not in a, you know, delusional way. At least, I mean, some people may be delusional, but Bitcoin paints a picture of a better world. I think that's that's really what it is. It paints a picture of a fairer, more, equitable, better producing world that gives more people a chance and makes more economic activity and all of the good things that come along with that. So I think Bitcoiners, and that's the feeling that I expressed multiple times in my book, that like this is all about making Bitville a better place. And that's what, you know, Bitcoin is making the world a better place.
Awesome. The book is called Bitcoin Money, A Tale of Bitville Discovering Good Money.
It's on it's on Amazon, and it's on my website, bitcoinmoneybook.com. You can buy it with Bitcoin and Lightning. and fiat, if that's what you like. But yeah, it's been great. It's been selling great, and you know, it's been all over the world, and tons of translations galore are coming out. So check if your translation is ready yet, or if it needs more work and you want to come help, then message me on Twitter at the Bitcoin Rabbi, and you know, you can join our translation team.
Very cool. All right, Bitcoin Rabbi, thank you so much for lending me some of your time.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Okay, that's going to do it for today. I hope you guys enjoyed that interview with the Bitcoin Rabbi. I know I did. You guys should go check out his book. Follow on Twitter at the Bitcoin Rabbi, and you can go check out his book at bitcoinmoneybook.com. You can also get it on Amazon, but I'm just going to tell you, go ahead and buy it from his site, because at least in the US, the shipping's pretty much the same, and you pay less and he gets more of it if you buy it through his website instead of Amazon. So just, you know, help a fellow Bitcoiner out there. I also included a link in the show notes to an episode of The Cryptoconomy where Guy reads an article about usury and debt and some of those kind of things in relation to Bitcoin, and then kind of gives his, he reads the article and then discusses it and kind of gives some of his feedback. And I thought that was really timely that I listened to that episode shortly after doing this interview. So I went ahead and included it in the show notes. Y'all check that out too. Don't forget to follow me at BottomShelfBTC on Twitter. And the latest way that you can support the show is go to lncast.com to listen to the episodes, and you can basically tip me over Lightning for each episode. So I am working on trying to figure out a way to put an ad-free version up on LNcast so that if you wanted to listen to the show without the ads in the middle, you could do that through LNcast. So if you like that idea, you think that's something that you would pay for, right? Like it's a per episode purchase on LNcast, and it's pretty cheap. I think I have it set right now for like 7 cents an episode or something ridiculously low like that. But if that's something you are interested in, you think you would appreciate, let me know and I will get to work on that. All right. From Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.